Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, what was the NSPA? Eli Adler is a professional cinematographer with more than 30 years' experience. He's a child of a Holocaust survivor and has filmed several Holocaust-related films. He was also a prolific contributor to the Shoah Foundation interview program. Adler grew up in Skokie, Illinois, a predominantly Jewish suburb of Chicago, where his family moved from the city in 1959. In the late 1970s, the town made national headlines when Illinois Nazis attempted to organize a march through the town. When local courts prohibited marchers at the proposed Skokie rally from wearing Nazi uniforms or displaying swastikas, the Nazis, arguing that the injunction violated their First Amendment right to free speech, took the case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and won. Although in the end the march never took place, the events inspired many of the town's Holocaust survivors to tell their stories and eventually led to the creation of the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center in Skokie. The dedication of that museum in 2009 and Chicago Tribune journalist Howard Reich's article, Memories of the Skokie That Was, inspired Adler, along with Blair Gershkow, to make the documentary film Surviving Skokie. The film is powerful and intensely personal, telling both the story of Skokie and that of Eli's father growing up in 1930s Poland and how he survived the Holocaust and rebuilt his life in the United States. Jack Adler later wrote a memoir, Why? A Holocaust Narrative, about his experiences, and now speaks to students and other groups about them. The film also includes the participation of other survivors and the historical context in which the Skokie incidents took place. Surviving Skokie has been selected to participate in more than half a dozen film festivals and has won a number of awards for Best Documentary.
Thank you very much for speaking with us today, Eli. Before talking about the film Surviving Skokie, could you tell us a little bit about your own background and some of the other film work you've done?
Surviving Skokie is the first film that I've produced, and I have been in the film business since 1981. I am primarily a camera person, or some call me a director of photography, and I've worked with many talented directors of documentary films over the years, and decided at one point I wanted to make my own. I've worked on films that dealt with the Holocaust in the past. I've worked on the Shoah Project in San Francisco when they were interviewing survivors for the Shoah Project. And I've worked on a lot of different documentaries, as well as corporate sales and marketing videos, commercials, you name it. But this was my dream to make my own film that dealt with my father and his past in the town I grew up in, Skokie, Illinois, back in the 50s and 60s.
Tell us about Skokie, because I remember Skokie. I'm old enough to remember Skokie, but many of our listeners, especially those who are not in the United States, may not be. So could you tell us a little bit about the community, what it was like growing up there, and especially what happened there?
Yeah, sure. Well, my father came to Chicago in the late 40s, and eventually we moved to Skokie in 1959. I was 4 years old. My sister was 2 years old. And he had earned enough money to buy his own home. And at that point, there weren't many places that were welcoming to Jewish people back in the 50s and early 60s. And it seemed as though Skokie was opening its arms to especially survivors and Jewish people. And as many Jewish people know, word gets around. So suddenly there was a mass exodus of survivors and Jewish people from Chicago, and they found themselves a safe haven in Skokie. And some estimates have it by the mid-60s, 50% of the population of Skokie were Jews, and 10% of the population were Holocaust survivors.
Wow.
So one in every 10 of the 70,000 people that lived in Skokie were Holocaust survivors.
Was that so, well known? I mean, did everybody know that?
That was not well known. Many survivors, in fact, most survivors, did not really talk about their past. They wanted to forget about their past. It was just too horrific, and they didn't want to burden their family with those stories. So I knew very little about my father's past. And though one in 10 people who lived in Skokie were survivors, there was a good chance that in my grade school classroom, three or four children were children of survivors, but I never knew that.
So when you were growing up, you felt perfectly normal being Jewish in your community. You didn't really feel there was anti-Semitism or any problems like that, I imagine.
Not at all. Skokie was, very well known for its tolerance of Jewish people back then. And there were many synagogues, many delis, many bakeries. You know, we could always get a good bagel and cold cuts in Skokie. It was just well known. Now, you know, there's always an underbelly. There's an undercurrent of bias. And, as I grew up in my early teens, I started hearing people refer to Skokie in a negative way. The O was replaced with an I. Many non-Jewish people referred to it as Skikey, which was very troubling to me as a child growing up. But I didn't experience any direct anti-Semitism growing up.
And was your mother also a survivor?
No, my mother was born in Chicago. So many survivors ended up marrying survivors, but my father did not. Mm-hmm. And I think that was partly because he was so young when he came to the United States. He was only 16 years old. So he became assimilated in American society and wanted an American wife.
So tell us what happened in Skokie that triggered your father's telling you about his past.
In the mid-1970s, there was a man named Frank Collin, who was a former member of the American Nazi Party, led by George Lincoln Rockwell. And he eventually was kicked out of Rockwell's party shortly after George Lincoln Rockwell was assassinated. And he moved to Chicago and he started his own organization called the National Socialist Party of America, the NSPA. And he took a lot of the ideology from the American Nazi Party and applied it to his own party and recruited men and boys who were disenfranchised and had nothing better to do, and grew this party to not large numbers, maybe about 25 or 30 guys. And they stormed around town in Nazi uniforms. They had a headquarters in Marquette Park in Chicago. And they primarily started to voice their concerns about African Americans moving into their neighborhoods. And eventually that turned into hating Jews as well. So they didn't want Jews in their neighborhood. They didn't want blacks in their neighborhoods. And they wanted to march. And in the mid-1970s, in 1976, they applied for a permit to march in Skokie, Illinois. And Skokie, Illinois, the mayor at that time was a Catholic man, Al Smith. And he was loved and revered by the largely Jewish population of Skokie. So he and the fellow city council members didn't know what to do. So they required a $1 million insurance liability for them to be able to get their permit, which of course they couldn't do. So the Nazis sought the aid of the American Civil Liberties Union, okay, the ACLU, mainly led by Jewish attorneys. So this little neo-Nazi group gets free legal advice from the ACLU, ironically, mostly comprised of Jewish attorneys and mostly funded by a lot of Jewish people. And they took this case through the state up to the Supreme Court for the right to march. Frank Holland thought that his civil rights were being violated by not being allowed to march through the town of Skokie. So this legal battle continued for almost a year and a half. And during that time, there were many survivors who came out to protest, and many non-survivors and thousands of people came out to support the survivors and the Jewish population of Skokie. And in the meantime, the Jewish Defense League followed Frank Holland and his group through some of their little marches in suburbs of Chicago, like Cicero and Berwyn. And wherever they showed up, there would be a fight would ensue. So JDL thought that might would get rid of their desire to march. The townspeople and the politicians and some of the Jewish leaders in the organization said, let them march. Close your shades. Just let them walk through town and it'll be over. Don't pay attention. Don't make a big deal out of it. So there was these contrasting approaches to how to deal with this. Ultimately, Frank Holland did win the U.S. Supreme Court decision to march through Skokie, yet for some unknown reason, chose not to. And I think personally, I think that it was this display from the JDL and the display of thousands of supporters of survivors and the Jewish people in Skokie that made them realize that their small band of 25 neo-Nazis was never going to make it through Skokie. They may not even have survived the march had they chosen to do so.
So is that when your father began to tell his story?
No. You know, many survivors went to their graves and never shared their stories. Every person had a different reaction to Skokie. It certainly opened the floodgates a little, but that was in the late 70s. It really wasn't until the early 80s that my father started sharing his story. And that was right after the birth of my first child in 1984. He was also retired at that point, and he started sharing the true depth of his story with me. When I was a teenager, really all I knew was that the reason I didn't have any grandparents or aunts or uncles was because they all died during the Holocaust. End of subject.
So did you start asking him about it, or he just opened up for some reason?
I started asking. I started asking. I was a curious kid, you know, 10, 11 years old. I didn't understand, you know, because all my friends had big families.
I mean, in 1984, when he started telling you this.
Oh, in 84. Yes. In fact, I sat down and I wanted to interview him. So that was the very first time we put him on a video telling his story. But of course, so much of it had been bottled up for so many years that it took a long time to unravel all the details. And I still don't know that I have all the details. During the making of the film in 2012 and onward, we interviewed him five times. And each time we interviewed him, a new story would come out. So it was like peeling an onion. There were so many layers and, you know, memories that he had either forgotten or suppressed. And there still are stories that come out when I talk to him afterwards that I had never knew and that he never talked about during the making of the film.
And he wrote a memoir also, didn't he?
He did write a memoir. It's called Y, the letter Y, a Holocaust narrative by Jack Adler. And that came out at about the same time that we started making the film. He always wanted to share his story and honor his family. And I can't think of two better ways to do that, to leave a legacy with a book and with a film.
Can you tell us when exactly you decided to make the movie and how you went about it?
Well, as I said earlier, I had always harbored a dream of making my own film. It was just a matter of what the subject would be and when I would do it. And in 2009, I received an email from a friend of mine in Chicago. I live in San Francisco now. And about the opening of the Illinois Holocaust Museum in Skokie. And I started researching that, and I found an article written by a Chicago Tribune columnist named Howard Reich called Memories of Skokie That Was. And that really triggered my interest in making this film, to the point that I couldn't sleep at night. I was just thinking of what this film would be, how I could make it, how I could get it funded, who I would talk to. And being in the film business, I own video cameras. So I also have a credit card, and I took off to Skokie in 2009 and interviewed many people who are in the current film, knowing that they were getting older and frail, and I wanted to capture their interviews before it was too late. So I interviewed about eight people in 2009 and found a co-producer who was also an editor, Blair Gershko, and he became my co-producer, co-director on this film. And he put together a short fundraising trailer based on the interviews and some of the archival material I had located. And we traveled around with that little fundraising trailer and finally raised enough funds to make the film.
And can you describe the film? Can you tell us a little bit about its structure? What kind of research you did? Did you travel anywhere? I think you went to Poland, didn't you, with your father?
I did go to Poland with my father. The film chronicles my father's past. And it starts, with me as a small child in Skokie wanting to learn more about my father's past. And then we go to Poland. I didn't go to Poland with him, but we learn about his family's journey through the Holocaust from a small village called Pabianica, where he grew up, into the Ludz ghetto. He had, at that point, lost his older brother and his mother in the Pabianica ghetto. And he and his two sisters and father survived the Ludz ghetto and were herded on cattle cars to Auschwitz. So we learn about his story and his family at that point. At the same time, we learn that Chicago in the 1930s is going through its own little renaissance with immigrants coming to Chicago and the seeds of prejudice are being sown because there's a lot of African-Americans moving to Chicago. So the film sets up the scenes and compares and contrasts what life was like in Poland in 1939 and Chicago in 1939. Mm. We follow my father through his experience, ultimately on the Dachau death march and spending time in a DP camp, discovering that he's the sole survivor of his family at 15 years old and is convinced that Chicago would be a good place for him to come by a friendly United Nations nurse. So he decides he's going to go to Chicago. They find a foster family for him. And we learn more about what life was like for him, learning a new language, getting an education, finding an American wife, raising a family, really avoiding any memories of his past, at least on a verbal level. You know, we know that experience is deeply rooted in his psyche, of course. But leading up to Frank Collin and the march through, or the attempted march through Skokie, which ironically was the reason for the Holocaust Museum in Skokie being developed. It started out as a small building where four or five survivors would talk to students. And this happened in 1980, I think, the very first Illinois Holocaust Museum or Holocaust Center was developed. And school buses from all over the area would come, and they would block up traffic, and kids would come to this teeny little building and hear the stories of the survivors, which for many of the survivors, the events of Skokie was the catalyst that allowed them and almost forced them to share their stories. They knew that it was so important to share their stories. It was not healthy to keep them secret any longer. And shortly after that, my father opened up as well. And he never wanted to go back to Poland.
That's understandable.
He really never wanted to go. But in 2012, we had the opportunity. He was invited by the March of the Living. And by that time, he had a lot of experience speaking publicly in Colorado, where he currently resides. So he's spoken to school students, children, college students, civic groups, church groups, the military. So, and that all started in 1993. So by 2012, he had almost 10 years of experience sharing his story. So in that sense, the timing was right. I wanted to go back to his town with him to see what Pabianica was like, to get a sense of the family that I never had the opportunity to meet. So it was the perfect storm. So we went to Poland in 2012, spent several days in Pabianica and Lodz. And my co-producer wisely convinced me to become part of the film. I didn't originally want to be part of the film. I just wanted to document my father's story. But he convinced me to do so. And I located a local video crew out of Lodz. And I'm so glad I did, because I think the power of the film is a lot of the father-son story, the way that we interact, the way that I learn about my father's past, and being on the same ground that he was on in the 30s during the war. And we go to Auschwitz together with the March of the Living children, and he continues to share his story. And that's pretty much the structure of the film and how it ends, on a very positive note.
Where has the film been shown?
Oh, boy. The film has been shown in Warsaw, where it won the Best Documentary Award at the 2016 Warsaw Jewish Film Festival. It's shown in San Francisco, in the Silicon Valley in California, Los Angeles, Denver, Atlanta. I'm on my way to Florida in 2 months to show it there. I recently returned from Charlottesville, Virginia, where I was invited to screen the film. And that was a very powerful screening for me.
Was that before or after?
That was after. And you know, many of the people in Charlottesville had no idea that something so similar to what had happened to them had happened 40 years earlier in Skokie. So it was a powerful moment for me to be there, and very emotional. You know, a lot of the people who were in the audience had been at the counter protests, and one of them even, you know, had a friend who was injured during the car incident. So it was, that was a great screening. It's going to be screening in Munich at the end of the month. It's screened in Australia, Chicago, of course, Seattle. It's won 3 Best Film Awards, and it is has screened in many festivals and private screenings as well.
So if any of our listeners are interested in seeing it, is there any way that they can do this without actually having a screening in their city or in their area?
That's a good question. That's up to I have a distributor who's trying to get it distributed in Europe. And people can email me, and hopefully we'll have some more information by then. I'm hoping that Amazon Prime will open up internationally. Right now, to my understanding, it's only available in the U.S. on Amazon Prime, mm-hmm. but I'm told that that might be changing. But I can't say that it is yet. I'd love for this film to be seen easily by anyone, anywhere in the world.
Okay, so should we include your email then?
Feel free to include my email. Yes, Eli@survivingskokie.com.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is English Corner @radiosephirah.com. See you next week.